Chapter 2. 60 Shu'erga pattern Xiphon interceptors screamed out from the hangars of the Kaljian and the Amujin, fell sharply to clear the wake of their mothership's main thrusters, then kicked into full speed. Behind them boomed 20 Storm Eagle gunships, slower but more heavily armed. The raiders spread wide, fanning out into hunting packs and boosting into prearranged attack paths. The convoy lay ahead of them, wallowing, sluggish, surrounded by its protective shell of escorts. The Kaljian moved to a high plane observation position, opening up with broadside volleys to hit the flanks of the distant Leviathans. The Amujin, the smaller of the two White Scars attack frigates, fell away to take up guard position further back, towards the local Space Mandeville point. Shibhan Khan glanced down at the spread of ships under his command, took in the velocities and the angles and the cohesion, and made his choices.
"Like sleeping cattle," he voxed, pushing his interceptor into a corkscrew climb.
Jochi, hurtling less than 30 meters from his starboard wing, laughed.
"Then we will wake them!"
The arrowhead formation of 5th Legion void fighters burst through the outer perimeter of guardships, far too fast to be tracked by the basic defense nets of the picket vessels. Lance beams scythed harmlessly above and below the diving interceptors, lighting up their bone-white chassis, the lightning strikes, the gold and crimson. The underhull of the lead hauler loomed ahead, rust-red, lit with half-moon plasma thrusters. Its long series of armored cargo units stretched off into the dark, like the shell of some immense creeping insectoid. Shibhan's squadron shot under the approaching lip of the rear engine housing, swerving to avoid the blur of lasfire pumping from servitor track cannons. Targeting wireframes rotated and shifted across the cockpit's forward viewscreen, latching on to 1,000 targets a second before isolating the most effective locus. Shibhan ignored the cogitated results and aimed the las cannons manually. Driving the thrusters to within a micrometer of their red lines, he strafed along the void shield warded flanks, watching fissures form at his weapon's impact sites.
"Bridge sighted," Shibhan voxed.
His fighter swung out from under the hull's shadow, then tore up the leading edge of the hull plates, sending multicolored static from the bulk carrier's void shields blowing outwards like spray from an ocean speeder. The rest of the squadron came with him, staying tight on his wing.
"On my mark,"
ordered Shibhan, switching to his fighter's missile control system. The Xiphon interceptors rolled into position, swerving around incoming lasfire, each one a blurred edge smear of speed. Jochi went high, pulling a whole gamut of projectiles with him and leaving the attack run ahead thinned of flak. The attackers cleared the last bulkhead, exposing the bridge complex perched atop the hunched spine of the bulk carrier.
"Mark!"
Rotary missile launchers sent streaks of neon white tearing towards the metal line horizon. Silent explosions rippled out, smashing through the vessel's shield generators. The interceptors ripped through a spray of burst armor plates, tumbling away from the kaleidoscope of debris.
"Hai Togoris!"
whooped Jochi, pushing his fighter's angles steeply back towards the hunting pack. All across the lumbering convoy, similar explosions lit up the void, each one taking out a bulk carrier's void shield coverage and leaving its heavy adamantium hull exposed. Pinpoint lines of lasfire and heavy round cannons kept driving out from weaponized flanks, but none of it was close to hitting the mark. Shibhan wheeled away, choking his speed for just long enough to arrest the overshoot, then nudged the muzzle of his fighter towards the gaping maw of the hangar mouths. For a moment, he thought he recognized the profile, the blinking marker lights, the chevron warning livery, the vast cliff faces of steel. He had hit 100 such targets over past months, and they merged into one another. That had become life for them all now, hit and run scavengers, taking out the weak and the slow, hampering the mammoth warfront, and pulling free before its enormous pincers could close on them. Every raid hurt the enemy, depriving him of the communication lines, materiel, supplies and troops that he needed. But it hurt them too, for the War Master had teeth of his own.
"Follow me in,"
Shibhan ordered, piling back into full velocity. The approach was thick with glowing lines of lasfire. The bulk carrier's crew were attempting to lower blast doors across the hangar entrance, and Shibon opened up with his las cannons. The piston arm shattered, leaving the blast doors half lowered. That left a gap of less than 8 meters to thread through at near full tilt. The test made Shibon smile for the first time on that mission, and his fingers clenched a little tighter around his control columns.
"We would do this for sport in another age."
He pushed down on the throttle and screamed low across the remaining ground. The hangar entrance swam up before him, and he slewed across its face before powering through the narrow aperture. Inside, a cavernous void opened up, easily capable of housing ships 100 times the size of his own. Enormous hauler claws hung from roof-mounted tracks, illuminated by the red fog of combat lighting. Ranks of landing platforms stretched away into the gloom. Shibon compensated for the shift into the bulk carrier's gravity well, switched to atmospheric drives, and applied his newly cycling air brakes hard. The Ziphon spun around over its center and came down heavily onto the nearest platform, shrouded in vapor and ribbons of atomizing plasma. The fighter's cockpit locks blew, and Shibon pulled himself from his seat, taking up his favored Guandao as he leapt down to the rock crete. Defense servitors were already shambling towards him, leveling autoguns and limb-mounted carbines. Shibon burst into a sprint, smashing the heel of his blade into the steel-ringed throat of the closest attacker, pushing away and punching his blade through the stomach of another, whirling around to smash the legs out from under a third, before pushing out and beheading the fourth. All across the hangar, his brothers were doing the same, powering from their fighters and racing out across the echoing chamber. None of them moved like Shibon, though. Where their weapon strikes were fluid, his were jabbing. Where they danced and fainted, he smashed and careened. Their armor was the same as the Brotherhood of the Storm had worn since the first days of its inauguration on Chogoris. Ivory plates, rimmed with red and gold, and marked with 3 lightning bolts, the sign of the Mingan. Only Shibon's right pauldron still bore those old marks, those old colors. The rest of his armor was a steely gray, pocked with shell craters and marred by the patina of combat. His plates were thicker than the others, knitted together with cables and clamps and fusion locks. He called those things the shackles, the damned mechanicum devices that kept him alive, kept him moving, kept him fighting. Within them, his body was now a mongrel thing, part superhuman, part ruined. Zu Ilya had spoken truly to him what seemed like a lifetime ago. "In another legion," she had said, "they tell me you might have been placed in a dreadnought." A half-tracked servitor with iron pincers for hands rumbled towards him, and he leapt, using metal muscle stims lodged amid the sinews of his body. The Guandao whirled, tracing a perfect arc through the smog-laced atmosphere, slicing the man-machine's upper feed cables. Shibon's momentum carried him into its embrace, and a crunch down from his clenched fist cracked its skull open, terminating the commands to its rudimentary impulse units. It was a move impelled by the embers of fury. It had never been that way before. He shoved the twitching corpse aside and kept moving. 200 meters away lay the first of many doors leading into the vast ship's interior. The 9 battle brothers of his Arban were close on his heels, only pausing to dispatch the last of the hangar's defense force. They converged on the doors to a lifter shaft, their armor spattered with thin blood and viscous engine oils. All his warriors were helmed against the void, and their armor was covered with unique battle marks, skulls, skins, signs of the vanquished, binding defeated souls to the armor of the one who had killed them. Joshi was carrying the severed head of a mortal trooper in one hand and let it thud to the deck.
"I do not think they saw us coming," he said.
"They saw plenty," said Shibon, mag locking his blade and pulling up a schematic from the wall-mounted cogitator unit. "They are weak, not blind."
He inserted a control wafer into the cogitator unit and the lifter access code cycled down his helm display. He took control of the access shafts, the ship's shield subsystems, 6 other critical lattice nets, and the base-level navigation grid.
"Anything then, Taxia?"
Joshi asked, his enthusiasm reduced, shaking the blood from his blade. Taksir. They insisted on calling him that, all of them now, and it was long past the time for resisting. Shibun interrogated the auger node implanted in his cranial interface. It caused him significant pain to use, just as every action, moving, breathing, killing, caused him significant pain. For a moment, all he saw was the local space tactical sphere, clogged with the burning shells of convoy pickets. The Kaljan remained in close, the Amujin further off. He was about to respond in the negative, to order the ascent to the bridge, when he sensed the first signal closing.
"Not far behind," he murmured,
as if that was something that had ever been different. He looked up, reaching for his locked glaive.
"They remain quick." "You have a ship mark?" Joshi asked.
"What does it matter?" said Shibun, calling up the lifter platform and activating his glaive's disruptor.
"They will come, and we will end them."
He paused before passing over the threshold. There weren't as many incoming signals as he had expected. That boded poorly for the opposite flank of the move. All the games were getting old, and perhaps even the Khan's mind could now be read by the enemy, just as they had seemed to read all else. A lifter platform shuddered into view on steam-wreathed metal columns, and the blast doors ground open in a trail of sparks. A ship ident flashed across his helm display, picked out in the Imperial Gothic runes that had once been a symbol of the dominance of humanity, and now felt like the emblem of its folly. Suzerain.
"Come," he said,
moving into the lifter shaft, his glaive glowing electric blue against the dark.
"The debauched are on our heels."
No ship was suffered to break the veil ahead of the flagship. The Proudheart shattered the barrier between realms first, and in its wake came the Outriders, pulling wide once the transition to the Materium had been fixed, and taking up pinpoint assault positions. Eidolon, standing in the observation tower of his private hull citadel, watched his fleet deploy ship by ship. The capital vessels fell into the Chemos-authorized formations they had used since the earliest days of the Crusade, covering one another's trajectories, mapping broadside solutions to each other, sliding into the abyss like sharks through the ocean's swell. They had lost nothing in precision. The purple and gold tide spread across the emptiness, hitting cruising velocity well within Legion expectations. Crystal spires glittered like frozen tears. Jewels reflected the light of the stars. It was beautiful, impressively beautiful. The Proudheart's main line deployment was joined seconds later by the arrival of Jewel Shard, Lepidan, and three other battlegroups tied to the Lord Commander's will. Four full-line warships, many more support vessels, from hunter destroyers to gun frigates, the kind of flotilla that would have once subjugated whole sectors, now running down those of the species who had refused the call to evolution. Eidolon felt his new glands twitch. He raised a finger and traced the line of his swollen throat, the skin as tight as a drum. He felt the veins pulse rhythmically, tracing out the irregular pattern of two hearts. Menials brought new armor pieces to be drilled and turbo-hammered into place. A six-legged augmetic drone clattered across the marble, bearing Eidolon's swollen gorget in three iron pincer claws. The armor piece had been chased with silver, picked out with bestiary from old Terra and Chemos, fluted finely, polished to the high sheen that had always been demanded. As the drone approached, Eidolon raised his chin, suffering its mechanical attentions like some old coiffured monarch. The gorget was clamped into place, and Eidolon felt filament needles slide into his distorted black carapace, locking fast and pulling ceramite hard onto flesh. As the sonic multipliers made their interface, an echoing snap spun out across the arming chamber. It was only a feedback glitch, but it still blasted open the cranial shells of the servitors, leaving several twitching helplessly on the flags. Eidolon turned to the tech priests, raising an eyebrow. The closest of them, a hunched nightmare of cabling and wire mesh cowls, bowed in apology.
"Refinements are still being made," it muttered.
Eidolon raised his arms to the horizontal, and the surviving menial shuffled forwards to clamp the plates into position. Every addition brought a surge of fresh pain, a toxic blend of his gene template being twisted into new and unsanctioned forms. Some of it he had learned to enjoy. Other sensations were less welcome, but in time he would no doubt find a way to turn the experience to his advantage.
"We are not the finished article yet," he thought. "There are still steps of sensation left to take."
A rune flickered into life over his helm display, indicating the arrival of Azael Koninos and his ships. Eidolon remembered the same marker lighting up before Istvan, when Koninos was not yet an orchestrator of the Cacophony, and he himself had only experienced one lifetime. Azael's loyalty had been complete and perfect then, just as it was now.
"Be welcome, my brother,"
Eidolon voxed. All around him, the drills whined as the bolts were dragged tight.
"Lord Commander,"
acknowledged Koninos, his voice also distorted by the augmetics of his own ruined throat.
"The barbarians?"
"They will come. My equerry doubts it, but they will come."
Out of the corner of his eye, through the crystal flex real viewers, Eidolon caught sight of the Ravisher at the head of the newly translated formation. The hunters were gathering.
"Take up position beyond the gate's leeward rim. Run silent and wait for the charge. Have you witnessed Kalion before, my brother?"
"I have not."
Tech priests limped towards Eidolon, carrying his helm aloft on a salver of gold. It was twice the size it had once been, chocked and studded with auditory dampeners and channelers, inlaid with the filaments that would slide into his inner ear and wrap around his sinus cavities. They lifted it high, and Eidolon looked up into its miraculous interior.
"Then you are fortunate," he said,
just as the rim of the helm came down, sealing him within the carapace of ceramite. Fresh shards of pain burned as more wires slithered into bone sockets.
"As we destroy what we once built, there are fewer wonders than there were. Feast on this one, and as we slaughter in its shadow, remember what we, the children of Terra, once dreamed to accomplish."
No one knew who had made it. All records were gone, lost in the long strife that had engulfed the galaxy before the Emperor's coming. It was ancient, that at least was certain, raised in a time when the technology of humanity had run amok, designed by those who had no fear of the blasphemous union of mind and metal. Perhaps that had been its undoing, those who had placed it into the gulf of the void, succumbing to the machine spirits sacrilegiously burned into its arcane core. The date of its abandonment would never be known. The gate had lain dormant and charred for at least 1,000 years before the explorator fleet of rogue trader Josiah Halliart had come across it while roving far ahead of the First Legion's obsidian war fleets. Halliart had searched it with his own forces, believing the structure to contain treasure worth plundering, but found only echoes and rust amid the dark. Frustrated, he had later sent missives to the Lion's command, which in turn had brought the Dark Angels to Kalium. They had claimed the entire subsector for Terra, sealing it off and sending in reclamator squads of their own. What they discovered was never made known. The records of transits from Kalium to Caliban were logged deep in the Narvis Nobilitae's archives on Terra, none of which carried official authorization, and all of which were buried. In time, the Lion himself had arrived, fresh from a conquest on 12 worlds. It was said that when his grey-eyed gaze alighted on the gate for the first time, he did not speak. It had been as if he could peer beyond its bulk, past the great curve of its inner mouth, and see into the maw beyond. When he had eventually stirred, the words had been typically few.
"Make this place fast. It guards many paths."
Perhaps he had sensed what the navigator houses only later proved, or maybe he had just been fortunate in his guesswork. Either way, the Lion's judgment was sound. The Kalium system lay at the juncture of 9 major routes through the warp. Great currents of pure ether surged about it, pushed by the vagaries of the Tempest Invisible. A fleet could enter the aperture into those deep streams and be thrown far across the galaxy's plane at greatly accelerated speeds. A journey of Terran months might take a similar span of weeks, something that was of great interest to the strategos of the Administratum as they planned the ever-expanding warfront of the Great Crusade. In this, the gate was not alone, for other such portals and cutways had been found in scattered wastes among the stars, but it was stable and within the Crusade's core expansion sphere, and thus of principal value. So it was that the First Legion did not retain ownership of the Kalium Gate, but it passed instead to the direct control of the naval echelons of the Imperial Army. More fleets arrived, first by established warplanes, then using the arteries under the gate itself. The old structures were secured and charted, and then built upon. Ancient bulwarks disappeared under new mountains of adamantium and iron. Strange harmonic vanes were replaced with batteries of macro cannons and void lances. Shafts of unknown provenance were filled in with lead-lined cells, ready to take the thousands of menials who would soon be shipped in from surrounding compliant worlds. Mechanicum crawler teams turned up and promptly disappeared into the depths of the core, emerging months later laden with locked caskets, ready for unscheduled and undocumented return voyages back to Mars. By the Crusade's high point, 100 battleships were passing through the gate every week, guided by 50,000 naval staff installed within the new refit yards and fortresses and sensor towers and docking berths. An artificial world grew like coral over the old foundations, obliterating the signs of an older civilization, until only a few archivists and sector commanders ever knew that the mighty staging post had once been a creation of humanity's era of semi-remembered terror and hubris. And yet, all knew, deep down, that the place could not have been made in any other epoch. Its size defied description. A colossal ellipse running around the neck of the warp inlet, 900 kilometers in diameter at its widest extent. From a distance, it resembled a glittering necklace in space, at once fragile and indomitable. Coming closer, an observer would see that the necklace, as it had become known, was composed of hundreds of node stations, each one linked to the next by heavy lengths of reinforced chain. Every one of those stations would have been a formidable star fortress in its own right, bristling with defensive weaponry and crowned with assault craft docks. All of them, though, were dwarfed by the pinnacle of the gate's mysterious architecture, the Keystone. The Lion had given it the name. At the apex of the great curve of the gate's collar, the Keystone swelled out into the abyss, bulbous, bloated, superabundant. It had taken 2 years to chart the full extent of its labyrinthine interior, and even after the army had assumed final command, large sections of it remained effectively mothballed and unknown. The docks were capacious enough to accommodate a star fort and its escort fleet, and the towers that clustered at its crown were the equal of any hive world spires. Huge protective arcs surrounded it, enclosing inhabited sections within concentric rings of cannon-laced adamantium. Its shield generators utilized archaeotech far more efficient than standard Imperial void shield capability, giving the entire edifice a permanent cloak of translucent silver. They had said that the Keystone was unbreakable. They had said that even a Legion fleet would be unable to penetrate that degree of shielding, and that, if supplied and manned and in prime condition, the Kalium Gate could be held indefinitely against any besieging force known to Imperial High Command. Perhaps some rumour of that boast reached the ear of the Lord of Iron, called Perturabo, Master of the Fourth Legion, and perhaps that wore at his ever-fragile pride. When treachery came to the Imperium, right at its apogee, it was his legion that took command of the Kalium subsector warfront. In those earlier months of confusion, rumour and counter-rumour, little was known or could be known of the movements of those Primarchs who had cast their lot with the Warmaster, and so the gate's defenders might reasonably have believed themselves as secure as any. In advance of firm orders from Terra, preparations were made. Drills were run, the resident fleet cordon reinforced. It was afterwards said that Perturabo took little pleasure in its swift and complete destruction.
"I desire the fall of only one fortress,"
he was reported to have remarked, even as the outer necklace still burned from the Iron Blood's punishing fusillades. Until then, count no victories. When the 4th Legion took to the void once more, they left the gate a smouldering tomb, spinning gently on its enormous axis, stripped of life and rendered back almost to the dormant state it had been in when discovered by Halliard. And yet, in all the tumult of a galaxy in flames, the Kalium Gate's destruction was just another statistic among a thousand other catastrophes. Amid the riot of intelligence and counterintelligence, much was missed, and more ignored. Though the supply fleets stopped coming, and access to the great warplanes was blocked by mines and the wreckage of the inner collar, few in the outer reaches of the galaxy would have known of its fall unless their fight for survival had demanded it. And so it remained a prize for the unwary, a nexus that now led nowhere, a ruin whose possession gained the victor nothing. But that had not stopped them coming. Even as the warships of the Emperor's children took up guard positions over the summit of the dormant Keystone Apex, new warp signatures registered out in the far void, dozens of them, moving fast, just as those of Jagatai's Legion always did.